The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from 3 to 4 p.m. for an hour-long millennial takeover. This is Maggie Thompson with Generation Progress. Check us out at genprogress.org or on Twitter at genprogress. All right. Welcome to the show, everyone. We've made it to Friday. This is Maggie Thompson with Generation Progress for the millennial takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. We've got a great show coming up for y'all today. We wanted to talk about Infrastructure Week, the real one, not the series of Infrastructure Weeks that Donald Trump has made us think he's working on. But before we get to that, we wanted to just take a second to talk a little bit about the news today. Many of you may have heard that there was a shooting today at a high school in Santa Fe, Texas. This is a community just southeast of Houston, Texas. According to current reports, there are up to 10 fatalities, but, you know, as we know too well, given how routine these shootings have become in our country, that number may change. For those of us that are keeping track, this is the 22nd school shooting in the United States this year. Law enforcement has the shooter in custody. I'm not going to say his name. He doesn't deserve that. But, you know, what's really important to remember and that we've been talking about in the last couple weeks is just where this shooting fits in sort of the context of where we are in the fight to end gun violence in our country. You know, the shooting happened in Texas, and less than 2 weeks ago, the NRA was down in Texas as well, holding their national convention, pushing forward an agenda that really allows these shootings to happen and for young people to continue to be gunned down in their schools and communities. And, you know, just last November, there was a massacre in Sutherland Springs in Texas that killed over 20 parishioners. So this is becoming the new normal in America, as we talked about on the show last week. We just released a report, America's Youth Under Fire, that shows that young people in America are now more likely to be killed with a gun than to die in a car accident. So on the show with me today is our very own Giovanni Rocco. He's a press associate here at Generation Progress. You know, we've talked a lot, and Giovanni has been working on this issue because, Gio, you are a young person that has, you know, this has touched so many areas of your life.
That's right.
So welcome to the show, Gio. And can you just walk us through, you know, a few weeks ago we had survivors here in D.C. talking about right. their experience, and you were able to sort of talk about how, you know, this is just, the gun violence keeps cropping up in your life. So you're mm-hmm. sort of living this new normal for our generation.
That's right. Yeah, that's right, Maggie. So, of course, like you mentioned, we had our Fight for a Future gun violence advocates in Baltimore, and, you know, we brought them down to D.C. And many of them are people that face or that have seen gun violence in their lives every day. As we know, gun violence is not just mass shootings, they're also cyclical gun violence, street violence, suicides. But in my personal case, I did not grow up in a community where gun violence was really an issue. You know, like, my parents never owned a gun. I don't think anyone in my family owns a gun. The schools that I went to, well, you know, felt safe. But yet I still am surrounded by gun violence. When I was in college, there was a shooting at the library on my college campus, and I believe three people were shot that night. I had friends who were in the Pulse nightclub, Pulse nightclub during the shooting. Thankfully, you know, I didn't lose anyone, but, you know, I remember that morning when I woke up and I was on Facebook and my newsfeed was just filled with people mourning or just, you know, frantically asking if their friends were okay. And then I had a friend who was at the Las Vegas shooting when that happened as well. And then, you know, my parents actually live like right down the street from Parkland, the city right over. And a school administrator that I went to high school with, that was he was a security guard during the time that I was in high school, was shot, and he died in Parkland. So again, you know, this impacts so many people. I think oftentimes in the media gets caught up on this idea that certain types of young people face gun violence, but it's everyone. And just, you know, earlier today, I was on Twitter. There's this video that's already gone viral. There's a reporter that asked someone from the high school where the shooting took place today. She was asked if she was surprised about what happened, or that if she thought it was real. And to quote her, she said, "No, it's been happening everywhere. I always thought it would happen here too. I wasn't surprised at all."
It's awful. Like, and so this is the new normal. It's the new normal by the numbers, and also just for the way people are experiencing
it. Exactly. People become desensitized to this issue so much because it's just all around us, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, according to the report that, you know, that we released a couple of weeks ago, you know, we know that gun violence has surpassed car accidents as the leading cause of death among young people 15 to 29. Like, that's just ridiculous. It's incredible to think that, you know, now people, young people who are, you know, elementary, middle, high school, are growing up in a world where the leading cause of death, or one of the leading causes of death for them, is gun violence.
Yeah.
You know, where people are not shocked to know that there's a shooting in their high school. So it's incredibly sad. But we also know that young people are the leaders in this fight, and as you and I know, since, you know, with our gun violence prevention network, young people are here, and they're loud, and they're gonna keep speaking up until Congress and the White House acts on this, because we can't just have thoughts and prayers anymore. We need action.
Yeah, absolutely. No thoughts and prayers today. Just action. And for those of you that are, you know, you wake up, this is in your news feed again, on this Friday, that there's been another school shooting. We wanted to talk about sort of what young people are demanding for action, and sort of the next moment that's coming up as part of our movement for you to take action. Many of you may have heard of Wear Orange Day. This is a day of action to stop gun violence across the country. That's coming up on June 2nd. That's a Saturday. So that Saturday, and then the Friday and Monday around it, there's going to be a series of actions across the country. I did want to take just a minute to explain, because not many people may know that Wear Orange is actually a movement and day of action that was started by young people on the south side of Chicago. You know, it went... It was founded in 2015. This was 2 years after a high school honor student and drum major at Hadiya Pendleton was shot and killed. She was killed in January of 2013. This was just about a week after she had come to Washington, D.C. to perform with her high school's band in Barack Obama's second inauguration. So really incredible young woman, devastating loss for her friends. So her friends at that high school in Chicago joined together and thought about what they could do. And the reason that we wear orange, that color on Wear Orange Day, is because they thought about what is the color that hunters wear when they go hunting to stop themselves from getting shot, to make themselves visible and stop themselves from getting shot. And that color is orange. So ever since then, in 2015, this has become really a rallying cry for the entire gun violence prevention movement, but especially for young people who, you know, really want to demonstrate and honor the people they've lost to gun violence, but also have a visual symbol to demand action. So on June 2nd, again, we are asking people to commit to take action. The easiest thing you can do, of course, is to wear orange. We, you know, like, go all out. I've got some orange rain boots I wear with my bright orange blazer, and, you know, get your community, whether it's your workplace or your friends, to do the same. And secondly, commit to real action, whether that's scheduling an appointment to go with your friends wearing orange to talk to your congressman in their in-district office. You can make that call today to tell them you need to talk to them, and learn more about other actions that you can take by signing up. If you go to www.genprogress.org/join, there'll be a checkbox there where you can indicate that you want to do something on gun violence, and we'll be sending out a toolkit and materials for Wear Orange Day. So let's use the news today to get mobilized, and let's put this on our calendars and make sure that we are coordinated and unified in the face of the NRA and its agenda. So that's the news today. We're going to take a short break now to go back to our regularly scheduled programming. We've got some great guests in studio to talk about the real Infrastructure Week. This is Maggie Thompson, the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. We'll be right back. Everyone, this is Maggie Thompson from Generation Progress, hosting the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. So, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that we had some great guests in studio here to talk about the real Infrastructure Week. I know people are like, but hasn't every week sort of been Infrastructure Week according to President Trump, and then he doesn't do anything on infrastructure? But there is actually a real Infrastructure Week and a coalition dedicated to really improving our country's infrastructure. So here in studio with us, I have Zach Schaefer, who's the executive director of Infrastructure Week. Zach, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We also have Jana Hoosman, who's the communications director for the Transportation Trades Department at the AFL-CIO. Thanks for being on the show, John.
Thank you. It's also really good to be here.
Awesome. So, I think that, Zach, maybe if we can start with you about what sort of Infrastructure Week is, because it's really an interesting mix of organizations that have come together to think about these issues. So can you just talk to people about sort of what this coalition is and what its goals are?
Absolutely. So Infrastructure Week, this is the sixth annual National Infrastructure Week. I know that it may seem to many people who have Infrastructure Week fatigue like there have been a few this year. We are glad that the issue is having a lot of traction, but we are an organization that's been around for a while. It was a bit of an accident in its origin, as a number of organizations in Washington and who work around the country, for example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the AFL-CIO, the Brookings Institution, the National Association of Manufacturers, so organizations you don't necessarily think of as the usual bedfellows, were all working on this issue and realizing that we could be stronger together, and that there are a lot of areas of goal alignment and policy alignment between business and labor, between business, labor, and local and state elected government officials, and then the goal beyond that was really to engage not just the usual suspects in the infrastructure world. So we definitely do work with the folks who build infrastructure, but we also work a lot with the folks who consume infrastructure, and that is manufacturers, retailers, the travel and tourism sector, and everyday citizens who rely on it every day. And so our work is to create a platform each year for those organizations and the people they represent and the businesses and the workers they represent, to be able to make their voices heard about how infrastructure matters to them, and then talk about the solutions that they need.
Yeah, and we hear all the time about our country's crumbling infrastructure. And Jana, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but you know, I think of this for young people as a jobs issue. But when people think about Infrastructure Week, they think about sort of older dudes working on construction sites and maybe don't have sort of a full perspective on both the need, you know, sort of what's the gap we have in terms of our crumbling infrastructure, but also sort of how is this an opportunity, not just for all Americans, but for young Americans?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that this really does impact all people, and it really does impact young people. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you talked about jobs. All Americans feel the impact of outdated infrastructure every day, whether it's in their commutes to work or in the types of jobs that they even have access to. So we're seeing that more and more Americans have much longer commutes. You know, it's regular for an American to spend an hour going to and from work. There's a group of Americans called extreme commuters that is really emerging. Mm-hmm. These people are spending upwards of 3 hours one way just to get to their jobs.
Yeah, like,
and
really,
that's like,
no.
That's stuck
nope.
in traffic.
That's awful.
That's, you know, taking multiple trains and buses and things like
so
that.
So 6 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's for the people who have jobs. We know that, you know, in Chicago, the overall jobless rate is 4.6%. But among 20 to 24-year-olds who are Black, the jobless rate is 60%.
Mm-hmm.
And a University of Illinois at Chicago study found out that a primary reason is that because these people lack transportation options to get to where jobs are.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is happening in Minneapolis, in Minnesota. There was a study done. The largest concentration of unemployed workers are actually qualified for entry-level positions, but they don't have a way to get to the jobs. So that's a, you know, a huge, huge issue.
And I'm, as someone that lived in Minneapolis, we had a bridge collapse for
exactly.
listeners that maybe remember that. So if that's not a cry out for investment in infrastructure, I don't know what is.
Huge, yeah. And I think the other thing, especially in terms of young people that we have to remember is college is getting more and more expensive, and
mm-hmm.
college just isn't an option for all young people, and we have to be able to create jobs for people who don't have the luxury of a college degree. And by not investing in infrastructure, we're leaving 900,000 good jobs behind every year. And these are jobs in industries that have high union density. So it means that these are really good jobs. They pay well, they have good benefits, and they're the kind of jobs that our economy just isn't creating. So you're absolutely right to say that by not investing in infrastructure, we are hurting young people and we are hurting their economic opportunities.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting the way that you frame this as sort of something not just for young people, but we talk all the time about how diverse millennials are. And, you know, all the cities that you mentioned, when you're talking about young people of color and this issue of being able to get to a job, those are also some of the most segregated cities in America: Chicago, Minneapolis, Milwaukee. So it almost feels as if we're also, by not investing in this, there are the obvious impact on commutes and our economy and all of that, but it feels like we are in places that need this the most, embedding sort of a form of segregation where we're not connecting these people with jobs that would really help them in the community overall.
Exactly, and you know, numbers show union jobs benefit everyone, but they especially benefit people of color and especially women.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think that, you know, before we go to break, you know, Zach, are Americans paying sort of extra money to take care of this infrastructure?
They are, and I mean, they're certainly paying in jobs not created and in jobs that they're struggling to get to. But there is like a real dollar value you can put on
mm-hmm.
this. So the American Society of Civil Engineers does a lot of work in this space, and you know, one of the best stats is that the average household in America pays $3,400 a year, or $9 a day, in, you can call it, a hidden tax. It's money that you're paying now that you shouldn't have to be paying, that you wouldn't be paying if our infrastructure was at the quality and the capacity that it needs to be at.
Well, I definitely want to dig into that more about sort of the hidden costs of this. But before we go to break, if folks have questions for our guests, you can always call in at 888-6-LESLIE. That's 888-653-7543. We have Zach Schaefer and Jana Huseman for the Real Infrastructure Week. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Maggie Thompson with Generation Progress for the Millennial Takeover of Leslie Marshall. Welcome back, everyone. This is Maggie Thompson with Generation Progress for the Millennial Takeover of Leslie Marshall. I'm back here in studio with Zach Schaefer from the Infrastructure Week, the Real Infrastructure Week, and Jana Huseman, who is with the Transportation Trades Department at the AFL-CIO. We were just talking about sort of why we need to invest in infrastructure as a country. What are the gaps and who would benefit from reinvesting in infrastructure? But Zach, I wanted to kick it back to you because, you know, you said this really well when we were talking over the break, that sometimes it's hard for people to wrap their minds around these like giant numbers that are in the billions or trillions in terms of how much of a gap we have in infrastructure spending or sort of like dated infrastructure. But sort of like, are there other ways that we can sort of like crunch the numbers to just demonstrate to people how much this dated infrastructure is costing them?
Totally. It's a really good question because, yeah, there are good numbers out there for the size of our infrastructure spending or investment gap of, you know, $2 trillion or $4 trillion, depending on what you're talking about, whether it's transportation or water or energy or broadband. But,
and just,
you know,
and this is everything from roads, bridges, like, does this count stuff like broadband? Like,
it does. I mean, we're taking an inclusive definition of infrastructure because, you know, this is a big complicated issue. There is no way to silo transportation from, say, broadband in the current age. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think faces a lot of young people is when you think about building your life. Mm-hmm. You know, you're coming out of college or high school or a trade program, and you're thinking about where am I going to work? Where am I going to live? How am I going to get from where I live to where I work? How am I going to get to my kids to school or to the grocery store? And we're a generation that doesn't believe that success means a house and two cars. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, yeah, you know, there's not one definition of what that means. So there are plenty of us who are either willing to give up a car or can't afford to have, maintain, store mm-hmm. a car. So, you know, say you're a car person, you're spending, in L.A., the average driver spends 102 hours sitting in traffic. That's 12% of their driving time is sitting
that's
in
awful.
Traffic.
As a non-car driver, that just is horrifying to me.
Right, and you know, say you're someone who works in a job that doesn't have paid time off. You know, that's 2.5 weeks of time. You know that you know you didn't even have paid time off, but now it's 2.5 more weeks of your year that you've spent not at your job and not with your family. You're doing something else that you need to do or want to do. That $3,400 figure I mentioned just before the break is the cost of additional cost to you as a household or as an individual of, you know, more brake repairs, more suspension repairs, the higher cost of the food or the clothing or whatever it is you're buying because shipments were late or because the cost, you know, of trucking something or shipping something through a port that's congested is higher. And, you know, but then again, you know, we're also in the digital age. So say you want to make the decision to find a job where you can work from home. That requires good broadband. Mm-hmm. Broadband isn't free either. That's infrastructure. And, you know, I was doing a little bit of digging on broadband costs. And, you know I pay about $80 a month mm-hmm. and, you know, for pretty good broadband in a, you know, a big city. But that's still $1,000 a year. The average American pays over $4 per megabyte for their subscription service a month. In Hong Kong, it's 20 cents. And it's probably a lot faster. And we get it. Hong Kong's like a tiny little, you know, city state, and we're a great big country with, you know, longer lines. But still, I mean, we are one of the most expensive countries in the world to access broadband, and we have huge swaths of the population, so lower income households in urban areas and rural areas, and then huge populations in rural areas, even in high income households, don't have access to broadband. Yeah. And that that makes it hard to participate in the economy. It makes it hard for companies. I mean, we have a lot of companies talking about issues they don't normally talk about that are, you know, about equity and inclusion and access, but because infrastructure is where that hits them. So mm-hmm. agriculture really cares about broadband access for farmers, for yeah. the companies that deliver fertilizer to farms, for so, you know, whether, yeah, we are talking about broadband, we're talking about transportation, we're talking about water, we're talking about energy, and all these issues are intersecting now. I mean, you know, if we want to have electric vehicles and a more sustainable future, we've got to find a way to charge those vehicles, and that's mm-hmm. going to have implications for the electric grid.
Totally.
So yeah, it's a complicated issue.
Yeah, and I think just to go back, I think that's such a great point about broadband, because I think people sort of hear these eye-popping numbers of how much it's going to cost to update our infrastructure or even just install broadband or those types of things, but when you look at the communities that have done it. I'm thinking of places like, I think, Kansas City, like Chattanooga, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. These are places that sort of invested in or partnered with a company to do universal broadband. And it's amazing because when I talk to legislators across the country, a lot of them, especially from rural areas, are like, man, all of our young people are moving away. We got to get them to stay. We got to figure this out. And you see these cities that are now becoming a magnet for young people
totally.
Who are coming, they're buying homes, they're starting businesses, and a lot of it just started with just having that access.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, you have cities that are cities and, you know, densely populated successful areas because they built roads. You know, nobody charged per foot for the road for someone to get on it. And you have cities like you mentioned, Kansas City, the Sly James, the very, very knowledgeable and entertaining mayor of Kansas City, was here for Infrastructure Week a year or two ago and talked about the partnership they have with, I think it's with T-Mobile, to provide free access to broadband. And it's really created like an innovation cluster, and it's become a hub for entrepreneurship.
It's a fun city to go to. Yeah. It is a vibrant city to go to. So if Kansas City can do it.
I think the other cost that we're forgetting when it comes to not investing in infrastructure has to do with what workers who work on the front lines of our infrastructure system face. So not investing means, you know, people on the front lines of transportation are dealing with old, outdated equipment. Mm-hmm. That's dangerous. They're understaffed, which affects everyone, you know, and then, like, you hear about, like, these ridiculously long lines at the airport, or the commute on the bus is, like, too long. People are getting more and more frustrated, and what are they doing? They're taking their anger out on working people. And so there's, like, the actual physical financial cost, but then I feel like there's also sort of a health cost and
absolutely.
A safety cost as well.
Yeah, there's this quality of life issue, too, for, you know, for everybody, and then also the people who work in the sector. And this is not a small sector. I'm trying to remember my Brookings dad's, Johnny, you might know better, but I think it's, what, 14 million people work in infrastructure, not just construction, but operations and maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a massive part of the economy. And these are primarily, you know, what should be good jobs and frequently are good jobs, but come with those other costs.
Yeah, and I wanted to go back, John, to some of what you were talking about how many of these jobs in the transportation sector are union jobs, and sort of what, like, that means. Because, you know, we think a lot about sort of, I think, you know, recent polling is that, you know, only 61% of people sort of approve of, have a, you know, positive impression of unions. I think if you can just walk us through, we've talked about the boon that this would be to jobs, especially for young workers, if we invested in infrastructure. But it's not just the jobs themselves, it's all the benefits that go along with being a worker that's part of a collective bargaining unit.
Right. So essentially, for those who don't know or who may need a refresher course on what a union is a group of workers who come together and they figure out what they want to make their work better, and then they present that to their boss or their company, and there's a mutual agreement, which is the collective bargaining agreement that you talked about, that both sides agree to, that say, you know, I agree to pay you this much for this kind of work, or let's say, you know, the work could potentially be dangerous, you know, these safety protections are going to be in place, that kind of thing. And so unions really act as an equalizer for working people. They set the bar and they raise the bar. And so it's not just people who are in unions who benefit. You know, let's say there's two factories side by side, and one factory gets a union. Suddenly, the non-union factory, those workers are going to see the benefits that the union workers get. And so it just,
in terms of, like, higher pay, better health care.
Exactly. It definitely, they raise the bar a little bit. They ensure that workers are treated with respect and fairness. And, you know, they also really make sure that workers have freedom. There's sort of that phrase, you should work to live, not live to work.
Mm-hmm.
And unions really encompass that and make sure that you can go to work, do a good job, come home, spend time with your family, and most importantly, be able to take care of your family, you know, and do all of the things that are stereotypically middle class, save for retirement, go on vacation, put your kids through college, buy a car if you want to. And we're just, you know, I think a lot of young people listening today realize that we're just not seeing a lot of that.
Absolutely. And so I think investing in infrastructure, jobs for young people, jobs that will help in places that desperately need it, especially for young people of color, and also unions and all the benefits that come along with that. So lots of reasons for young people to be excited about investing in infrastructure. And Zach, I wanted to talk to you about something that we've worked a lot on in a past life when we were both on the council or at the Council for Environmental Quality, climate change and infrastructure. This is a whole other sort of facet of this issue, and just, you know, There are opportunities there, but also just how climate change is working with this issue in terms of just driving up the costs of the improvements that we need to make. So can you just talk through some of the numbers and
sure.
how that impacts everything that you're thinking about from an infrastructure perspective?
Absolutely. And this is funny coming back full circle. Maggie and I used to work together at the Obama Council on Environmental Quality. And when I worked there, you know, the big project that I was working on the water policy team was the federal government's climate adaptation plan for water resources, and a lot of what they were talking about was infrastructure. One of the big things had to do with insurance, and this year during Infrastructure Week, we've seen an enormous engagement from insurance companies because they care about, you know, this really impacts their bottom line. They're in the business of risk management. Climate change means that, you know, it's non-stationarity. Things are not the way that they used to be. You can't depend on them, and insurance companies like dependability and reliability. And and when you look at what's happened over the past year, everything from hurricanes, and not just the past, I mean, Hurricane Sandy was a turning point, Hurricane Katrina was a turning point, and then the hurricanes this year, the wildfires, but also non-extreme weather events. I mean, you have what are called sunshine flooding in places like Annapolis dozens of times a year. Mm-hmm. That's where it's just a high tide now is over the wharf in town.
And also is salting all of the fire hydrants and the things that need to be replaced.
Right, it's salting the infrastructure, which we're already struggling to repair because it's old. And now you've got salt water rusting the pipes even faster or corroding the roads even faster. You've got massive snowstorms to recover from, and the cost is huge, and preparing for it is important. And this is a real area where the government can play a role in helping to set standards, you know, saying you need to build above the floodplain, and this is resilience, and climate change is, you know, we know that climate change can be a scary topic for you know, some folks in Washington, but resilient.
Not for young people.
Not
We're
for
like,
young
yep,
people.
But it's happening.
We
don't
get
you
it.
See what's happening around us?
But when
Mother
you,
Nature's going
but
crazy.
If you want to talk to a fiscal conservative who wants to spend, you know, whether it's at the federal or the state or local level, you want to spend dollars wisely, well, don't spend them again and again and again. So build it right the first time. Build it to last. Build it to withstand whatever's going to hit it, and build it to come back that much faster. So at our kickoff event on Monday, actually, Brock Long, the administrator of FEMA, was one of our speakers and talked a lot about the role that infrastructure plays in responding to natural disasters or even non-natural disasters. It doesn't matter if it's a hurricane or, you know, God forbid, a terrorist attack, which are also, by the way, frequently targeted at transportation centers and other public infrastructure assets. You know, there was an attack a couple years ago where cyber terrorists tried to open the slough gates on a dam above New York. So this is an area, whether it's a natural threat or a man-made threat, where infrastructure is how people are going to experience that. You know, whether it's disruption to our daily lives, it's higher costs, it's, you know, it's a lot of different things that, you know, infrastructure is where climate change, you know, hits the road, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those, you know, we talk about this a lot at Generation Progress because we're working on sort of like a climate story bank. So where people who are directly impacted by climate change can tell their stories. And, you know, talking about it in our team meeting earlier this week, we realize that part of the challenge is that so many people that are experiencing some of these issues, their commute is longer. You know, if they work in municipal government, there's less money to go around because of repairs that are needed. All of these things, or even just extreme weather events, a lot of people might not realize that sort of the sort of these adverse experiences that they're having are driven by climate change. So it's how do we close that information gap and make people sort of see that, like, addressing climate change and investing in infrastructure aren't mutually exclusive, but they're linked, and we have to do both. And illustrating how
Absolutely.
Climate change is affecting people's lives through its impact on our infrastructure.
Absolutely. And that's one of the goals of things like Infrastructure Week, and we are not the only week when you're allowed to talk about these things, but one of the things we try to do is to encourage people to talk about the issues facing their sector, their community, their business, et cetera. And we've had, you know, probably close to a dozen events on climate change this week in D.C., people talking about, you know, hardening ports to climate and extreme weather risks. We've had an event in Houston today about rebuilding from Harvey but not rebuilding for Harvey, but rebuilding for the next storm or the next sets of issues.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're just about to our hour, but before we wrapped up, Jonah, I wanted you to talk a little bit about another issue that is near and dear to the heart of many a millennial, affordable housing and infrastructure, and how those two issues play.
Absolutely. I feel like the New York Times actually did an excellent piece on this sometime last year. There's a woman named Sheila James in California who has to have a 3-hour commute to get to her work because she can't afford to live by her office.
Absolutely.
It's ridiculous. So the more transportation options we have and the better infrastructure we have, the more people like Sheila can have good jobs and spend more time with their families.
Absolutely. So if you're a millennial paying that high rent with a long commute infrastructure, this is the issue for you. Zach Schaefer with Infrastructure Week, Jonah Hoosman from the Transportation Trades at the AFL. Really quick, where can people find out more about you?
Well, for Infrastructure Week, go to infrastructureweek.org.
And for Transportation Trades, we're at T as in T, D as in dog.org.
All right, that's Maggie Thompson wrapping up the Millennial Takeover of Leslie Marshall. We'll talk to you all next week. Welcome back, everyone. This is Maggie Thompson with Generation Progress. Before we wrap up this episode of the Leslie Marshall Show, we have Luke Vargas from Talk Media News to give us the latest on what's happening around the country today. Luke, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. What's going on?
I've been watching these NAFTA talks, which of course have been dragging on now for 9 months, despite us getting assurances from the president last year. This was trade priority number one, and a better deal was easily within reach. Turns out this is proving a lot more difficult than the president expected. And Paul Ryan, go figure. I mean, we could talk about how this seems to be a trend, both when it comes to sort of negotiations on the foreign policy side, just kind of adding everything to the agenda right now, and that's, you know, stretching the State Department thin. And then on the trade side, you see the president early on in the administration kind of telling the Brits, the European Union, the Koreans, the Japanese, the Chinese, NAFTA countries, everyone, that they're first in line for a deal. Turns out, you know, nothing is really moving fast. And Paul Ryan last week basically stood up to the president and said, look, if you want my Congress to even vote on anything before the next Congress is sworn in, you're going to need to give me a deal by the 17th of May. That's yesterday. So we've obviously passed that. Robert Lighthizer, who's the U.S. trade representative, came out with a statement saying there are gaping differences between the countries. They're nowhere close to a deal. So we're really not going to get anything in 2018. And should we get something later in the year, it's very possible Democrats taking one or two both houses of Congress could shoot down a deal if it doesn't uphold certain labor or environmental provisions that the Trump administration might not have been arguing for this year. So this is all very much up in the air. The Canadians are still a little bit upbeat. The Mexicans are very downbeat about the prospect here. And I think that is because they know they're going to get a new president in July. He's likely going to be this far-left candidate, Obrador, who is increasingly willing, it seems, to want to go toe-to-toe with President Trump, and he's not going to be quite so compromising. So kicking the can down the road, this NAFTA deal's not going to be wrapped up this year, it doesn't look like.
Yep. It seems like every time they set a deadline, whether it's on this or immigration, they just miss it. there was a lot happening this week in Gaza and with the U.S. embassy opening recently. Can you give us an update on what's happening there?
Yeah, I'll give you a 30-second recap. So basically, the U.N. Human Rights Council today has authorized a war crimes team go to Gaza to investigate. Israel and the U.S. were strongly against this. The U.S. was able to convince Australia to vote against this, but that's not enough. So there will be a team going there to look into this. And the thing to watch for next week is a resolution in the UN Security Council. Kuwait wants to send international peacekeepers to Gaza so that the Israelis aren't even really in a position to fire on protesters like they did last week. So lots to watch.
Great.
On that front.
Thanks so much. That was Luke Vargas from Talk Media News. This is Maggie Thompson with Generation Progress, wrapping up the millennial takeover of Leslie Marshall.